Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with sharp insight and expert analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead of the game. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's gambling boom leaves a trail of broken lives. Trump versus Musk when ego collides with egonomics. Wellness is selling, how health trends are reshaping retail in South Africa. Pay me now, young South Africans pushing the rise of on-demand earnings. It's Wednesday, the 11th of June. Now, today I want to shine a light on a crisis that I think is hiding behind glitzy ads and mobile apps. South Africans are placing over R1 trillion a year in bets, with R700 billion going into sport. But behind the hype, real people, particularly low-income earners, they are drowning in debt, I imagine, anxiety, and in extreme cases, probably even suicidal thoughts. With me now is John Manyike, who is head of financial education at Old Mutual, and they have done some work into the social costs of gambling. Who's profiting? Who's hurting? And what needs to be done? So, John, a very warm welcome. And the numbers obviously don't lie. R1 trillion in annual bets, R700 billion, as I said, on sport alone. Why did this whole notion of gambling explode into a crisis? And there's been little public outcry until now.
No, absolutely. I think one has to appreciate the fact that, you know, gambling has become very appealing in very tough economic times, especially when you look at people with limited financial resources. Others are gambling just merely to make ends meet. I mean, we've run a survey annually at Old Mutual Savings and Investment Monitor. What we saw in 2024 was that 36% of the respondents who gamble actually said they gamble to pay off their debts and to cover their expenses. Well, others, they're gambling because of the potential to earn a quick buck, you know, but it has certainly become a challenge. And it is not a coincidence that it's exploding at a time where there's a rising cost of living and the economic pressures are on, and with high unemployment.
John, what's more disturbing, that figure of 36% climbs to 41% for those earning 8,000 to 15,000 rand a month. And that suggests to me that gambling has become a destructive coping strategy right now.
No, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the emotional side of gambling, that's taking its toll. And this is a phenomenon where people are now gambling excessively. And we know for certain that, I mean, it leads to financial strain, especially those who are under pressure, you know, and others continue to gamble because they're trying to cover their losses of their previous bets. And we've also had stories of people committing suicide because of gambling and losing a lot of money. You can lose your family. Others end up indulging in substance abuse and all sorts of things, you know, because it certainly can damage people emotionally and financially.
I suppose one has to ask the question then why there is so little accountability, particularly for advertising when they are saying that easy wins are attainable.
Well, look, the fact that gambling is legal in South Africa and many other countries around the world, I guess marketing would do certain things with the conscience that, well, what we're doing is not illegal. But what is said, though, is that, you know, a lot of people fancy their chances of making it big. I mean, that's probably part of the problem, because the structure of the betting odds, it makes sure that the bookmakers maintain their profit. So, you know, a bettors who is actually risking their money, they believe that they've got a better chance of winning. But the reality is there's a built-in disadvantage in the whole system. The system is designed to favor the house. But because I have this fantasy that one day I can wake up and then I can wake up a millionaire, and it keeps drawing people to continue gambling.
And in that respect, I mean, let's look at one headline which says turning 4 Rand into 83,000 Rand. And we read of these viral success stories. But essentially, when you see something like that, it's predatory marketing, isn't it?
No, absolutely. It is, because it's actually preying on people's minds and because they believe they can win. And look, a business is a business. I mean, let's face it, and any business is entitled to advertise itself. I mean, you can use any marketing strategy. But sometimes we also have to look at the ethics around this advertising. I mean, is it really ethical? But we do know that there are other NGOs that are doing their bit to try and raise awareness about the risk of gambling, and they keep encouraging people that winners know when to stop. But the reality is that there are people who need counseling. And I think we need some kind of responsible business dealings where the very same business would encourage people to be conscious and to gamble responsibly, whether people will apply it or not. But at least they've done their part to also raise awareness. I believe some of those trillions need to go towards raising awareness.
So it's all very well for the NGOs to be doing work in this respect, but I wonder if government is putting in enough safeguards. And I'm thinking, for instance, like age verification or even spending gaps on these platforms. Is that happening, or is it happening sufficiently?
I don't think that's happening sufficiently enough. I don't think we're doing a lot of vetting. But I guess, you know, some of these platforms, when you sign up, they will ask for ID number. So I think on the part of these businesses, you cannot falter them, because they do ask for this. I believe they do ask for ID numbers and all that. But whether the verification is enough, I mean, or whether we are ensuring that people are gambling within the right age is another. But even those who are within the right age, are they gambling responsibly? That's the big question.
It's not just gamblers, of course, who suffer, John, families as well. And have we in any way quantified the broader social impact? I'm thinking of things like broken relationships, or even things like domestic abuse, or something like missing school fees.
Look, I think we yet to have a research that quantifies the impact and the adverse effect of gambling and its toll on families. If there are, perhaps it's not out there in the public domain in the way that it should. But I certainly believe that there's a lot of that happening around. And we do sometimes hear stories of, you know, people who have committed suicide, and we know they've been struggling with gambling, and let alone the fact that others might be losing their jobs. Because, I mean, I look at some people who go and gambling at night in the casinos, for example, and until early hours of the morning, there's absolutely no way that that person can wake up in the morning and still perform optimally in their workplaces. So when you lose your job, you are then you're adding to the unemployment stats, and we've got, the family has got all sorts of problems from there.
So where do we go to now with this problem? Should it be a ban on advertising? Is it stricter licensing that's needed? Should profits be funding rehabilitation? Where do you think we need to head with this problem?
I think it's a combination of all those things you've mentioned. I mean, we do need these businesses to, if they are, well, I think maybe they should also let us know that, look, we are contributing as whatever percentage of our profits towards awareness. Maybe we could potentially have a regulation that says they need to spend a certain percentage of their profits towards these campaigns. But these campaigns doesn't have to be done by them. It can be done by independent bodies, NGOs, or, you know, in partnership with government, to make sure that indeed we are raising awareness about the risk of gambling and the need to gamble responsibly.
Thank you very much indeed. That's John Manyike, who's head of financial education at Old Mutual.
Join the South African Guide Dog Association in the Give a Cane campaign, running from the 5th of May to the 18th of July. Help us provide 1,000 white canes to visually impaired people by donating just 50 Rand. Your donation goes towards white canes and training, which helps our clients stay in touch with the world around them. Want to do more? Host your own fundraiser, get your book club, social group, school involved, or encourage your community to donate just 50 Rand. Be a part of someone's journey to freedom. Visit www.guidedog.org.za for more information.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is an interesting one. From TikTok therapists to YouTuber sports drinks, I think we're living in an age of what is termed egonomics, where fame is currency and the loudest voice often trumps the best idea. Now, well-known branding expert Mike Abel argues that we've entered a marketplace where personality is replacing product and attention has become the most traded asset of all. But is egonomics a new paradigm or just another branding buzzword? And if it's all smoke and selfies, what happens when the algorithm turns? Joining me now is Mike Abel. He is from the M&C Saatchi Group. Mike, a very warm welcome. And this is interesting. You say attention is currency. I understand that. But hasn't that always been true? Isn't egonomics just a new label for old tactics?
Thanks for having me, Jeremy, and excited to have the conversation around this. I think there are very many differences between, I guess, this age of egonomics that we enter into now, where influencers really, or famous people, have become the product itself. And the product has almost taken the background. So we're not living in a time, I guess, where people are investing in craft or in ideas or in innovation. We're investing in fame and in influence. And I think that is very different. So when you had the old days of, or still very current, I guess, of celebrity endorsement, the product itself was a good product, tried, tested from a firm, you know, whether it's a sports star wearing a pair of sneakers or whether it's somebody who's promoting an established brand. That's very different to launching, I guess, a beverage, which becomes a sensation. I mean, I remember being in London a couple of years ago and my sons wanted to buy this drink called Prime. I'd never heard of it. And I gave them a £50 note because that's all I had in my wallet at the time.
And there was no change.
Getting very little change. And I said to the guy, I said, what's going on here? And he said, this is a very famous product. And I remember actually, you know, tasting it, and it tasted, well, to my taste buds, at least awful. But when you look at over 50% of fall off in sales last year, you know, the product itself doesn't stack up to the brand. And I think that that's what we've seen over and over, these disproportionate payments because of the people behind the products versus the products themselves. And that, I think, is the fundamental shift here.
So, Mike, you argue that egonomic brands lack depth, but I'd come back at you and say many so-called influencer brands really do drive sales and loyalty. It's not just about the noise, is it?
Yes, well, I think that we have to have a look at what will stand the test of time. That's always the best measure for these things. So when you look at, you know, whether or not it's a podcast host who's launching supplements, or you're looking at Kylie Jenner, who, you know, has sold, you know, 50% share in her brand to Coty, I think for $600 million, or whatever, you've got to look at how those things do longer term. So one of the biggest brand still in the world and has made the owners multi-billionaires is Chanel. You know, Coco Chanel died, you know, I don't know, 50, 60 years ago at least. Chanel number 5, I think, was invented somewhere round about World War II. And it still sells an absolute fortune. You know, then you look at another brand and you say, okay, Michael, give me another example in the same category. And I could say, okay, well, let's look at Liz Taylor. Liz Taylor launched her White Diamonds brand, I think, around about 1991. By 2018, that brand had done $1.5 billion in sales. So you say, okay, well, obviously people must like the smell of White Diamonds. But then what right does a Liz Taylor have? Because she's an influencer. No, she's not. She's actually an iconic and legendary actress who had probably got 60 years of acting under her belt. She was a famous celebrity for her jewelry. So the whole thing played into the narrative, Jeremy. And today, I don't think you need any pedigree. I don't think you need any credibility. I don't think you need any history to be that. I mean, I was looking at Greta Thunberg now, an unrelated thing just before this interview, to see what are her credentials as a climate activist, okay, because she's been nominated a number of times for a Nobel Prize for the climate. Well, she's never studied the climate. She's got no credentials, academic or otherwise, to talk about the climate other than getting cross. And in today's world, that's good enough to become a global expert. So,
Mike, you single out two other brands. You talk about Hermes and Apple, and you talk about their authenticity. But don't they also trade on hype and status? So is that not just ergonomics in a suit, perhaps, just better dressed up?
Well, I think the condition of ergonomics relates to individuals and to people. So I don't think that people paid a premium for Apple because of Steve Jobs. And if you have a look at Apple's performance since Jobs passed away, it's continued to be spectacular. Hermes, well, I'm not aware of any families or celebrities behind Hermes other than it being, I guess, it started off as a great saddle brand for the equestrian industry. So you're talking about brands there that have got real pedigree. Okay, if you look at a brand like a Prada, well, there is a lady, you know, Miuccia Prada behind it, or a Giorgio Armani, there's a Giorgio Armani behind it. But those are fashion designers who've got pedigree in that space. So yes, I think there are brands that are premium brands, like Apple is a premium brand. People are prepared to pay more for it, but you pay more for it because of the innovation and because of the quality of the product. I don't think you're paying more for something facile. I think you're paying, well, probably a 20% premium because it's a status brand, but the inherent product itself is of the quality, whereas egocentric or ergonomic-driven brands are personalities. I mean, we've just watched the showdown right now happening in the White House with, you know, Trump and Musk. That's political ergonomics. That's got nothing to do with policy at all. It's just got to do with primacy, you know, two alpha males having it out.
So, Mike, again, let me test your argument here. You go on to say that ergonomics is shallow, but I'd come back and you'd say maybe that's a bit elitist. If people are buying the story, doesn't that immediately give it value?
Yes, in the short term, it certainly does. I guess for a brand purist, and maybe I'm a bit of an anachronism in this regard, but I like to look at something to say, what is the longer term value of this? You know, a fortune of money is being spent behind creating, producing, marketing, driving this thing. There are a lot of people that are being employed by it. It's driving an economy. It's in shops. What is the implication of that thing fizzing out within a 24-month period? What does that look like for the people that are part of that whole thing or that have invested behind something like that or have bought shares in a company that has, you know, kind of risen like a rocket and then exploded in space? So I kind of look at value more from a longer-term perspective, Jeremy, than the short-term. And maybe it is an elitist mindset, and if it is, I'm comfortable with that. But I do think, you know, as I say, it creates fast money but slow loyalty. And I'm more interested in, you know, slow and steady wins the race, things that have got real meaning, real purpose, real utility, rather than just hype. And I think they hype brands. That's what I think ergonomics is about, is purely hype and faddish.
And Mike Abel, I'm going to need a quick answer to this as we come to the end of the conversation. You also suggest that this bubble might be bursting. Yet the virality of these brands that rely on ego are still driving billions. Is there real evidence that the model is failing?
Well, I think there are very few examples, Jeremy, that one can cite where you can say that thing was built on hype and it has managed to sustain itself. By the research I've done with a number of these brands that just took off, they all seem to be tanking to an extent. Their market share and their values and their sales have more than halved. So if you say, okay, we'll give you a different example, I could say maybe the Aloe yoga brand. Now, Aloe preceded the Kardashians. The Kardashians are the people that put it on steroids, much like an influencer would or a celebrity endorsement would. But Aloe, the product in and of itself, is a much better product than these brands that are just built off off hype. Same way as, you know, Roger Federer's investment in the sneaker brand, Takis, as we would say in South Africa, On is inherently a really good product. The fact that Roger has invested in it, people aren't buying Ons because of Roger Federer, but people are buying Kylie Jenner cosmetics because of Kylie Jenner. And so unless she stays in the headlines and unless she stays hot, the brand itself loses its relevance because the brand is reliant on the personality.
Mike Abel, fascinating conversation. Thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate your time.
Remember when you had to hurry up and wait, and cars could only run on fossil fuels? Well, hurry up and catch up. You don't need diesel power. You just need a second electric motor. With Volvo plug-in hybrids, you can drive electric in the city, switch to fuel for the long haul, or combine both when you want it all. So what are you waiting for? You're late for your test drive. It's safe to be brave with Volvo.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
While most sectors are still struggling under the weight of cautious consumer spending, South Africa's retail health sector is quietly surging ahead. And there's some impressive numbers here. A 7% growth in March alone. Small pharmacies, independent practices are proving to be resilient. And they've become, I think, community-driven engines of healthcare and economic momentum. That's good news. But how sustainable is this growth? And what role does smart funding play in keeping these frontline businesses healthy? I'm going to talk now to Christina Muki, who is head of medical partnership operations at Merchant Capital, and let's discuss the trends and some of the truth behind those numbers. So, Christina, a very warm welcome. That 7.1% growth statistic, it's impressive, but how much of that is real expansion versus inflation or base effect recovery from weaker periods?
Jeremy, firstly, thank you so much to you and the listeners. I'm so excited to be on the show. So I think what we're seeing is there's definitely expansion. The growth is coming from expansion. And this expansion is ultimately driven by preventative care and the notion of preventative care coming to the fore for our medical fraternity. So what this is going to the doctors for your annual visits, making sure that all of your screenings are done upfront is really driving the growth. Also, we are seeing that, you know, there's quite a lot of investment into the retail side of healthcare. So buying of your vitamins, making sure that, you know, you up to scratch when it comes to your health is becoming, quite critical.
Interesting that you position small pharmacies and smaller medical practices as growth hotspots, but they would also surely still be heavily exposed to rising medical input costs and late payments from medical schemes, which is often the case, as we know.
Absolutely. It's a pressure point that I think all medical specialists experience. But the reality is our pharmacies are our first line of defense against common illnesses and provide preventative care. And they actually increase accessibility to healthcare in some communities. So absolutely critical, but that requirement for funding in order to support them becomes paramount.
And that's the real problem, because a lot of those practices, I'd suggest, are surviving rather than thriving. So what do you think the real default risks are that you're seeing on the lending side?
From a lending perspective, actually what we're seeing is there's real growth, and some of the stories and case studies that we have shown growth. You know, practices that have come to us requiring whether it's a new machine or they need to market their business a lot more. And the growth has been exponential, 200%, 700% in some cases, right? But the important thing is that, you know, doctors as well as pharmacies are finding lenders that are actually going to be flexible in the way in which they work. And I think that becomes very critical. So not just traditional finance, where at the end of the month, you may get a big facility that you need to repay, that may be very expensive for your business, but rather getting something that's a bit more flexible and tailored to the industry.
So in terms of that flexibility, then, how would a company like yours be changing its approach to risk modeling?
So firstly, we look at an industry and we base our risk based on the industry. So when we're looking at the medical side, we work on the ethos of repay as you practice. So what this ultimately means is our repayments are tailored with how your revenue is, right? So in the months where you are receiving more revenue, you'll likely pay back your facility a lot faster. But in the months where you are seeing a dip in patients because it's quiet and your revenue is down, then you will actually repay us less. And if it so happens that as a medical practitioner, you decide that, you know, you want to take a month off because you'd like to go and, you know, study further as an example, then in that month, you're not going to repay us at all. So we've really built in, you know, the repay as you pay so that, you know, it can assist doctors.
But part of the problem there is that you've got to be very aware that these borrowers don't become over leveraged in chasing expansion during the boom.
Absolutely. And that's why we really take the time to understand what the project is that, let's say, for example, a medical practitioner will be undergoing and how it's going to serve their business. We do have also 48-hour turnaround time, which I think is very important. Sometimes the need is pressing, whether it's expansion or otherwise. And we are governed by SASFA. SASFA is a body that ensures that we responsibly lend to all of our clients. So we really try to make sure that we don't over-indebt, but rather assist in the growth of the business.
There is, and I just want to pivot slightly, there is concern, and I think you'll concede, that private sector-led funding in healthcare often can deepen inequality. So critical that you ensure that your support benefits broad-based patient access and not just profit margins.
Absolutely. I think, you know, I'd rather shy away from commenting on that. We are in the space of assisting those in private healthcare and SME businesses in South Africa altogether. But I think that there is a need for, you know, government and private to sit down and have a discussion around how best to assist all.
The problem is that discussion is perhaps not happening quick enough.
Perhaps, yes.
Let me talk to you about telemedicine and the digital health tools, something which is also being expounded on. Sounds great in theory, but is this technology available for either township or rural-based practices? Often we know that businesses like this would either have limited funding or budget, should I say, or limited bandwidth.
So the technologies are there. So technologies, just to expand, such as your EHRs, your digital diagnostics, your telemedicine, as well as there's AI, which is assisting medical practitioner scribes, so for patient notes, or to predict patient volumes or digital stethoscopes. I think that the technology is definitely there, but again, the funding and making sure that you have the right funding partner may be where, you know, the discussion point is or the determining point is. Yeah.
And Christina, just a very quick answer to this one. And what would you say to a skeptical GP or to an independent pharmacist who sees growth funding, as we've been discussing, as just more debt with a nice name?
I think as a GP or any medical specialist, take the time to understand, you know, what your business plans are, firstly. And maybe you want to invest in new technology or new AI, or you want to market yourself a bit more, or you want to find a way to buy yourself a bit of time. Take the time to first understand that. Ask yourself, would a flexible, asset-free lender be able to assist you in that? And then maybe look into whether they are reputable. You know, are there any bodies that are governing them? Do they believe in responsible lending? And how can they walk the journey with me? And if that lender can tick all of those boxes, then absolutely take the leap, because you may find that you're actually walking the journey with a business that can help you grow and can buy you time and allow you to be able to provide better service to your patients,
which is
ultimately going to impact everyone.
And that is not only good advice for your sector, but for business generally, is do your own due diligence. Christina Mooki, thank you very much indeed. Head of Medical Partnership Operations at Merchant Capital. Appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, as you well know, it's Youth Month, and while unemployment remains a real crisis, there's also some innovation on the rise. One of the fastest growing fintech trends is earned wage access. And young South Africans are leading the charge. Instead of turning to debt, they're unlocking wages they've already earned. Denise Detling is with me now from the financial wellness provider PayMeNow to explain what the shift tells us about youth money and financial empowerment. Denise, a very warm welcome. And what, in your opinion, then, is leading to this turnaround, this new trend?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Yes, I must say it is inspiring to see how the youth are determined to take control of their financial futures. You know, our youth are clearly eager to adopt this innovative financial solution, like you say, like earned wage access, to navigate the economic pressures while avoiding traditional debt traps and just going on to quick fixes to cover mid-month expenses or unexpected expenses. It's great to see that they're adopting this. It's very inspiring for the country moving forward into the future to see that our youth are building a great foundation for their financial futures moving forward. Like you say, on PayMeNow, we've seen a massive increase in the demographic 18 to 33. It grew by 132% in people adopting earned wage access. And it's great to see that they are shifting their mindsets as to how they manage their money from an early age to ensure they have a strong foundation moving into their futures when it comes to their finances.
Give us your best definition of earned wage access.
Earned wage access is basically getting access to money before the end of the month, money that you've already earned to cover unexpected or emergency costs that you didn't budget or bargain for. We all have these unexpected costs, and while you work during the course of the month earning money every day, you have to wait until the end of the month before that money is paid to you. Now, if something comes up and there's an unexpected cost and you don't have alternative funds or access to credit, you have to turn to loans or loan sharks to cover these costs. Now, having these unexpected costs already put stress on someone and has an effect on your productivity. Knowing that I can use the money that I've actually already worked for, I've put in the hours, I've worked for it and I've earned it, knowing that I can use a portion of that really gives me that dignity back, knowing that it's my own money, I am back in control, and I'm now not reliant on a loan or on debt to cover these costs. So that basically, in a nutshell, was earned wage access is, or access to your earned wage.
So Denise, how would you respond to critics who say this model still promotes short-termism over real saving habits? Essentially, it's just another payday advance, isn't it?
Well, in a sense, it is an advance on your salary, yes. However, with earned wage access, there's first of all no interest that is charged to the money that you advance. Second of all, you get the control back in your hands, and it's your own money. So you're not borrowing from anybody. You are in control, and you are basically saving already because there's no interest that you're paying. So in a sense, earned wage access is already promoting saving, because instead of having to pay the money back at the end of the month with interest, and we know that loan sharks and machinistas, they charge a ridiculous amount, you are only paying back what you, or basically advancing salary that you've already earned. So yes, there might be critics, but remember, the fact that earned wage access exists doesn't mean that people will no longer have mid-month expenses. We all have it. We're not going to stop the fact that you have it, but getting access to your own money as opposed to having to get a loan is the best alternative to keep you in control and empowered with your finances.
The challenge, of course, for employees and employers is to avoid this becoming a revolving door of early wage access and cash flow stress every month. It can't surely be something that happens in perpetuity.
No, definitely. And, you know, we do see when we implement with a company, you do sometimes see at the start of the implementation or the start when it goes live, there is possibly a surge because it's something new. People are adapting. But because our platform is coupled also with financial education, it's very important that it's not just earned wage access, but also financial literacy training. Then we shift their minds because they start thinking differently about the money. So earned wage access on its own is maybe not sustainable, but when you couple that with financial literacy, it teaches people to budget, how to manage their money better, and how to look at their money moving into the future very, very differently. So yes, then we see it basically, the usage not come down, but it kind of goes on a middle ground. We see that people are only accessing it for emergencies. They're accessing it for transport money to get to work. So yes, there is a surge at first, but because we train them financially as well, they start to think differently about their money and how they spend and manage it.
Denise, one figure leaps out at me, and that's 132% growth in users between 18 and 33. And I'm wondering if that reflects smart financial planning, as you've suggested to me, or also a degree of desperation, particularly among younger workers.
It might be. Remember, there's a lot of challenges that face our youth at the moment. We have high unemployment rates. work is scarce, cost of living is quite high. So it might be, it can go either way, but the fact that we see the surge in earned wage access as opposed to getting loans must be a positive for us to see that, yes, there might be a desperation. There's a lot of financial stresses that face these guys, but at least they are turning to sustainable habits or a healthy alternative in covering these costs, in managing their money. So, yes, it is concerning, but it's good to see that they're choosing the better alternative to build a strong foundation with their finances.
And just a final one, is there a danger that employers could use earned wage access as a substitute for paying living wages or offering real financial benefit?
There might be, but at the end of the day, earned wage access is still a way in which you are looking after your staff. You're allowing them to be more focused at work. You're allowing them to be more productive at work because they don't have to go and ask their managers for loans, or they don't have to know someone at the company knows that I've got financial stress. So yes, that might be a way in which they substitute it, but if you look at the benefits that earned wage access brings and the positive effect that it has in the workplace, we receive so much positive feedback from our employers saying the work culture has improved, the productivity has improved. So in that sense, yes, there might be risks also in an employer doing it, but replacing it with earned wage access has a lot of positives that I think outweigh the negatives.
Denise Nietlung, thank you very much indeed from the financial wellness provider Pay Me Now. I do appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.